Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Instagram propose des outils pour la famille qui permettent à vos proches de naviguer de façon raisonnable et en toute sécurité sur l'application. Quand les ados créent leur profil Instagram, les comptes privés par défaut garantissent que ce qu'ils publient n'est visible que par eux et les personnes qui les suivent. Choisir une limite quotidienne de temps aide votre ado à naviguer de façon raisonnable sur Instagram. Et paramétrer les outils de supervision ensemble vous offre une meilleure visibilité des comptes suivis par votre ado. Pour en savoir plus sur ces outils et en découvrir d'autres, rendez-vous sur instagram.com/outils pour la famille.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Chris Berrow, and at 14 GMT on the 1st of December, these are our main stories. Israel attacks Hamas as the ceasefire agreement in Gaza comes to an end. Palestinian prisoners freed from Israeli prisons say they suffered abuse after the October 7th attacks. In Dubai, world leaders deliver strong statements on the second day of COP28. Also in the podcast...
Society doesn't encourage women to go out there and do daring and dangerous things.
Meet the female conservationists on a mission to save gorillas in Uganda. Also... How many naps do penguins take in a day? We'll find out. Israel has resumed its combat operations against Hamas, ending a 7-day temporary pause in fighting that saw the release of 110 hostages held by Hamas and 240 Palestinian prisoners held by Israel. Explosions and gunfire have been reported in Gaza. One source told the BBC that Hamas believes Israel broke the truce by not allowing fuel into the north of the Gaza Strip. James Elder from the UN Children's Agency UNICEF is in southern Gaza.
It's terrifying. It's horrendous for people. You see the fear on their face. It's very obvious. I'm at Nasser Hospital, now the biggest functioning hospital in Gaza. There was a strike 50 to 100 metres from here. The ambulance is there. I see the plumes of smoke. We're in a massive hospital that's wildly overflowing with children and people with the wounds of war recovering from the last attack. This is the nightmare that everyone utterly feared.
Our correspondent in Jerusalem, Hugo Beshega, gave us this update.
The Israeli military has confirmed that it has resumed its offensive against Hamas in Gaza. There have been Israeli airstrikes targeting a number of positions across the Gaza Strip. And we had a statement from the Israeli Prime Minister's office saying that Hamas had breached the terms of the ceasefire by launching rockets against Israel and by not releasing all women who are being held captive in Gaza. And the release of those hostages was a key element of this ceasefire deal. We understand that talks continue right now. Mediators from Egypt, from Qatar, are still trying to reach a deal between Israel and Hamas, but fighting right now has resumed in Gaza.
And those talks, they're over other hostages, presumably, but I think the remaining hostages are more men rather than women and younger boys.
Exactly. So we've seen that more than 100 people have been freed so far, women and children. And in return, Palestinian women and teenagers have been released from Israeli jails. 140 people remain in captivity in Gaza. And most of them are men and Israeli military personnel. Now, our understanding is that Hamas is against the idea of keeping the same terms of the initial deal to release those men from captivity. So it could be that Hamas is making some demands in terms of the Palestinian prisoners being released. And it seems that this is one of the main obstacles in these negotiations that continue.
Are there positive signs that that may yield results? Because at the moment it doesn't seem like it's that likely, given that the fighting has already resumed.
Yeah, we know that there is a massive international effort happening right now to extend this deal, not only to allow the release of those hostages. American officials who have been heavily involved in these negotiations have been saying that the goal is to keep extending this pause in hostilities to allow everybody to be released. And also, I think there is a lot of pressure from the UN, from aid agencies, for the ceasefire to be extended or for a deal to be reached so more aid can get into Gaza, I mean, much-needed aid into Gaza. The humanitarian crisis continues, and I think, obviously, the news today that, the ceasefire has expired and that fighting has resumed is obviously very concerning for the people in Gaza.
Hugo Bashega. Meanwhile, some of the released Palestinian prisoners say Israeli guards abused them in the weeks after the 7th of October attack. The claims have been denied by Israel's prison service, which says that all detainees are held in accordance with the law. Our Middle East correspondent Lucy Williamson has visited one prisoner, 18-year-old Mohammed Nazal, who spent 3 months in jail without charge and arrived home in the occupied West Bank in the early hours of Tuesday morning.
We're driving through the occupied West Bank on our way to the northern city of Jenin. We're on our way to visit a Palestinian teenager, Mohammed Nazal, who was released from Israeli jail.
Mohammed says after the Hamas attacks on the 7th of October, the behaviour of Israeli prison guards changed.
The dog attacking me wore a muzzle with very sharp edges. His muzzle and claws left marks all over my body. Then they started beating us. They took our mattresses, our clothes, our pillows, and they threw our food on the floor. People were terrified. I felt humiliated and insulted. The fact they attacked us with their dogs, sticks, and arms, when we are unarmed and not able to defend ourselves.
Mohammed's hands are heavily bandaged. His family show us x-rays and a medical report from a hospital in Ramallah on the day of his release. Both documents say his hands are fractured from a beating by prison guards, Mohammed says.
They arranged us so that the elderly prisoners were put in the back and the young in the front. They took me and started beating me. I was trying to protect my head. And they were trying to break my legs and my hands.
Israel's prison service says Mohammed's story is false and that a medical examination before leaving prison found no problems. It published a video of the teenager boarding a Red Cross bus after his release, with his hands unbandaged. Mohammed says his wounds were first treated on that Red Cross bus. Photographs of him reuniting with family on arrival in Ramallah show his hands in bandages. Another prisoner released this week, Lama Kata, alleged in a video on social media that an Israeli officer had threatened her with rape shortly after her arrest in late October.
I was handcuffed and blindfolded. They threatened to rape me. It's clear the goal was to intimidate me.
Israel says she has denied the incident and that it's filed a complaint for incitement with her lawyer. But Lama Kata told us that women prisoners, including herself, had indeed been threatened with rape. The head of the Palestinian Prisoners' Society, Abdullah Al-Zaghari, said he'd heard testimony that suggested guards had urinated on handcuffed prisoners. Israel's prison service said it was not aware of the claims, that all prisoners were lawfully detained, had all the basic rights required under law, and could file an official complaint. In Kabatia, Mohammed's brother Mutaz told me something had broken in the teenager.
This is not the Mohammed we know. He was much stronger back then. It's as if his heart is filled with terror.
Mohammed was released in exchange for Israeli hostages kidnapped by Hamas, one of the group's key goals in carrying out the attacks. Those attacks, Mohammed says, not only changed the lives of the Palestinian prisoners released, but those in Israeli jails.
Lucy Williamson. The world leaders are meeting in Dubai for the UN Climate Change Summit, COP28. The United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres described global warming as a sickness bringing our climate to its knees. King Charles III also made his address to global leaders.
I pray with all my heart that COP28 will be another critical turning point towards genuine transformational action at a time when already, as scientists have been warning for so long,
we are seeing alarming tipping points being reached. I've spent a large proportion of my life trying to warn of the existential threats facing us over global warming, over climate change and biodiversity loss.
I spoke to the BBC's environment correspondent, Matt McGrath, who's in Dubai, asking him what COP28 might achieve.
The leaders will be here for today and tomorrow, and they will probably agree on a number of measures on climate change, such as perhaps the tripling of renewable energy and the doubling of energy efficiency by 2030, as well as probably putting in large amounts of money into various climate funds. King Charles's speech in the hall was at the very start of the leaders' segment, and it went down very well, I think, with the audience there. Obviously, kind of preaching to the converted, but he has a track record of speaking at these major events. He spoke before the Paris Agreement, and he mentioned it in his speech that he had given the opening address there, and that had turned into great success. He's hoping it can actually be repeated here as well. He painted a very stark picture of the impact of climate change on the world, saying that we're carrying out this vast, frightening experiment of changing all ecology and all nature all at once, and that our children, our grandchildren, wouldn't judge us by our words in 2050. They'd judge us by what we're doing now. So it was a very clear message, a very strong message, and I think it really summed up the sense of some hope that things can be different, but also that the scale of climate change that the world is facing is particularly frightening.
You mentioned some of the funds and some of the money. We know that the UAE president has announced $30 billion worth of funding for global climate solutions, he said. These kind of funds, I guess they are very useful if that money does actually go on to properly tackle climate change.
Yeah, we don't really have very many details of what that fund will be and how it will work, but it's certainly, in terms of the scale, is probably something way bigger than people have heard of before in relation to finance. I understand it's going to work as an investment fund and that it hopes to attract other investments totaling to about $250 billion by 2030. Now, it certainly is the type of money that developing nations say they need to cope with both the impacts of climate change and to help them to adapt and move away from fossil fuels. So I think it will be seen as in the right ballpark in terms of number, but how it's delivered, whether it's money that's given in the form of loans or whether it's given in the form of grants, that's a big issue. A smaller developing country say that we want help, but we don't want to be just burdening ourselves with extra loans to cope with the impacts of climate change, a problem we didn't start.
Our environment correspondent Matt McGrath from Dubai. And we've been talking a lot about climate change on the Global News podcast, partly because of the COP28 climate conference. Now, these discussions usually focus on the dangers faced by humans, but animals and wildlife are equally affected. Experts say that rising global temperatures are threatening thousands of species. Well, when Gladys Kalema Zikusoka began working in Uganda's Bwindi National Park about 25 years ago, the number of mountain gorillas was falling fast. But under her care, the population has increased by two-thirds. She spoke to the BBC about her daily routine in the park.
Climate change is one of the major threats to the gorillas. As there becomes a scarcity of water, there's drought, the gorillas are going to struggle. The climate has warmed up a few more degrees, and a lot of people are getting malaria because they weren't exposed to it before, and they're really getting sick. All these increased infectious diseases, eventually there's a spillover to the mountain gorillas because they're always interacting with the communities. We're preventing zoonotic disease between people and wildlife, and we work closely with village health teams or community health workers who we train to do conservation work. We make sure that they visit people's homes regularly. Each of them is in charge of about 30 to 40 homes. And they promote good hygiene and sanitation, especially hand washing. Society doesn't encourage women to go out there and do daring and dangerous things.
I'm noticing it.
Being out in the bush with limited amenities, they frown upon women who do things like that. So trying to break those barriers and say, I'm going out to do it because I really want to do it, I found that there haven't been that many role models, but I'm glad that the role models are increasing over time. There's many more women now engaged in conservation, although we still have a long way to go. We need to regularly monitor the gorillas' health. I'm collecting fecal samples from the night nests of the gorillas. Every night the gorillas build a bed, a nest, a comfortable bed where they can sleep. And in the morning as they're getting up, they're defecating it. So from here we have a nest of a mother and a baby, two silver bucks and one black buck. Every month we collect fecal samples from all the habituated gorilla groups, currently there are 26, to look for parasites, bacteria or viruses that they could be picking from people or livestock. And also when they're abnormal, we carry out a lot of clinical science observation. The climate crisis has made many people to feel hopeless. Sometimes I feel hopeless, but one thing that makes me hopeful is that there's something that can be done about it. Working with gorillas gives me a lot of hope. It really does.
Dr. Kalema Zikusoka, who's on this year's list of BBC 100 Women Recognising Influential Women Around the World. And you can find the list on the BBC News website. Well, still to come.
But how did it happen? How did it get there if the author didn't write it and the translator says it was there when she translated it? Where did it come from?
The mystery continues as the author Omid Scobie denies intentionally naming two senior royals embroiled in a palace race row.
Comment ma fille et moi pouvons-nous définir qui peut lui envoyer des messages? Comment parler avec mon fils des bons comportements à adopter en ligne? Si vous avez des questions sur la sécurité de vos ados en ligne, vous trouverez des ressources utiles dans le Centre Familial Instagram. Le Centre Familial vous permet de paramétrer la supervision parentale avec votre ado. Et dans l'espace éducation, vous trouverez des conseils d'experts pour discuter de sécurité. Découvrez nos outils pour la famille sur instagram.com/outils-pour-la-famille.
Now, a district court in the US state of Montana has blocked a statewide ban on the TikTok app from coming into effect in the start of January. The judge ruled that the proposed restrictions infringed on the constitutional rights of both users and businesses. Shingai Nyoka reports.
The Montana law, which would have come into effect on January the 1st, sought to ban users from downloading the app. Download stores and TikTok would have faced fines of $10,000 per day for each violation. But a U.S. district judge blocked the ban, ruling that it violated the constitutional rights of users and businesses. He also accused lawmakers of being too fixated on China's influence. The judgment is an important test for other states mulling similar bans. It comes amidst a growing fear that TikTok could hand over sensitive user data to the Chinese government. It's something the video platform has repeatedly denied it would do.
Well, next, lured to Myanmar with the promise of good jobs and then forced into crime. Well, that's what seems to have happened to more than 100 Malaysians who've now been repatriated. They were flown back via China. Our Asia Pacific regional editor, Mickey Bristow, told us more.
It's a very complicated story, this, but it appears these Malaysians were lured to Myanmar by the promise of good jobs, high-paying jobs. Lots of countries have high youth unemployment. They arrive in Myanmar and then find that actually these jobs don't exist, and then they're forced, this is what's suspected, they're forced into by criminal gangs into taking part in online and telephone scams. Real big issue in East Asia at the moment, where they try to essentially defraud people by telephoning them on, contacting them using the internet, defraud them of kind of lots and lots of money. This group of Malaysians aren't the only group who have been found over recent weeks. Hundreds of mostly young people from Vietnam, Thailand, Indonesia, other countries in Southeast Asia have also been repatriated after being located in this area of Myanmar on the border with China. It's called Shan State.
How were they found?
Well, it appears that they've been found at the moment because in this area over recent months, there's been a real uptick in violence, in fighting between an alliance of ethnic groups, and they've been fighting the Burmese army. One of the aims of this alliance of groups appears to be to clear out this kind of lawless border area where a lot of casinos were operating, a lot of gangs were operating these telephone and online scam groups. One of their aims appears to be clear out these groups, these illegal operations. And that's how it seems that these Malaysians and other people have come to light.
And what next for those who have been repatriated? I'm guessing it's the difficult job of rebuilding your life in some way.
Yeah, it's a really complicated question here because, as I said at the beginning of this, they're suspected of being lured there to be involved in criminal gangs and online fraud. But a few thousand people a few weeks ago, several thousand people were repatriated to China. The Chinese described them as criminal suspects. So it's not entirely clear. Some of them will have been lured there with a promise of jobs. Some of them will be taking part voluntarily in these kind of frauds. So it's not quite easy to see exactly whether they're victims or perpetrators. Of course, as you mentioned there, those that were victims, they're going to find it hard to readjust when they get back to Malaysia and their home countries.
Mickey Bristow. A former Haitian paramilitary leader who spent a decade on the run before serving a prison term in the US has been deported to his home country. Guy Philippe led a rebellion that overthrew Haiti's president Jean-Bertrand Aristide nearly 20 years ago. Analysts say his return to Haiti after serving a jail term will further stoke instability in the country, where gangs have taken control of large areas since the assassination of President Jovenel Moïse in 2021. Jacqueline Charles is the Caribbean correspondent for the Miami Herald. She spoke to my colleague Victoria Unhunda about the reaction in Haiti.
We know that he was released from a U.S. prison in September and people were expecting him to be returned to Haiti immediately, and that did not happen. And so when we at the Miami Herald broke the news that he had arrived back in Haiti, a lot of people were unaware. He does have his supporters, and so they have been anxiously awaiting his return. He was taken into custody by Haitian National Police. A number of his lawyers were outside of the police station demanding access to him. And of course, on the other side of this, there are people who are waiting to see what does his return mean when you think about the current context of Haiti. This is a country that has a political vacuum since the assassination in July of 2021 of the Haitian president. The current prime minister and his supporters have not been able to reach just some sort of a governance agreement that would allow the country to go to elections. And of course, we know that gangs have overtaken the capital. And this week, the UN issued a report that says that they are also invading, you know, rural communities outside of Port-au-Prince.
You briefly mentioned about the instability in Haiti. Just to remind our audience, what is the political context of all of this and what Guy Philippe's deportation or repatriation to Haiti might mean?
Well, as you know, that Haiti is a country right now that's dealing with a number of crises, a very multifaceted crisis. There's a humanitarian crisis. There is a political crisis. There is a gang crisis. Immigration advocates have pointed out is that on the one hand, the United States is deporting Haitians, not just Guy Philippe, but you know, thousands of Haitians have been deported back to the country since President Biden came into power. And this is happening at the same time where the United States is trying to get an armed security mission led by Kenya, you know, into Haiti. I mean, today, Haiti is a country, for lack of a better word, it's very chaotic. And so, again, when you see that you're returning individuals back to this country, everybody's sort of trying to understand the policy. And, you know, and that contradiction is what they view and what does it mean. And as far as Guy Philippe, I can't answer that question because there are so many more questions are surrounding, you know, what happens tomorrow that we just don't know. I think with him, you just have to wait and see how he fits in and how his return fits into the current landscape.
Jacqueline Charles from the Miami Herald. Well, next, an author whose book has triggered a row over allegations of racism within the royal family has said the naming of two royals in one edition was an error. Omid Scobie said he didn't know how a Dutch translation of Endgame included the names of King Charles and Catherine, Princess of Wales. They allegedly discussed the skin colour of the Duke and Duchess of Sussex's unborn baby. Our royal correspondent Sean Coughlan is following the story.
The publishers, first of all, said that there was a translation error, and everybody looked at tried to compare the Dutch version with the English text. And I suppose what was most striking was that there were additional lines rather than lines that could have been, where there could have been some confusion about the vocabulary or what was intended. You can't actually just put a name in and say that's a problem with translation. These are extra lines. And we know the author of the book, Omid Scobie, has been very clear that he had never submitted any version which included these names. He's been saying that through the week, several media interviews, he's asserted that. He's also said very strongly this wasn't any sort of marketing stunt, which again raises the question, how did it happen? It's not at all clear yet. I think this is very much a live story. The publishers have yet to reveal their investigations. But how did it happen? How did it get there if the author didn't write it and the translator says it was there when she translated it? Where did it come from?
Something's missing at this stage then. And has the palace reacted to this publication yet?
The intimations have been that all options are open, which again kind of raises the prospect of legal action. But it's not at all simple because initially there was a reluctance to publish the names in mainstream media, but it was all across social media. Where do you go? How do you put it back? How do you put the genie back in the lamp? The information's out there. So their options are quite limited as well. So I think they'll be waiting to see whether or not this investigation shows this was a mistake or a hack or perhaps a deliberate leak. I think they'll be waiting to see.
And we've mentioned already on the programme, King Charles is in Dubai. He spoke earlier on at COP28. Is this going to overshadow some of the comments that he made? I mean, I suppose he's one of those named.
Well, the timing is excruciating, really, because there he is on perhaps one of the biggest days of his year, making a keynote speech in front of world leaders and on a subject about which he feels passionately. But the papers at home are just full of stories about a race row and who said what to whom 2 years ago in a conversation which we don't really know how it happened. And it's the sort of thing where he wants to appear like a serious broadsheet monarch, and here he is dragged down to the tabloids again, having to explain stuff and not being able to, in a way. How can he address this problem? And it must be awful for him in a way, and I don't know how he balances those two parts of his royal identity.
And I guess just finally, now we wait to see what happens. I mean, that's the only thing we can do.
Well, that's right. I mean, we just want to know, how did this happen? If we know more about that, and that depends upon the publishers telling us, then I think then the story could move in lots of different directions.
Sean Coughlan. There's nothing worse than not getting enough sleep. The recommended number of hours for humans can vary depending on where you look, but the old adage is that you should try and get around 8 hours. Well, it turns out that penguins haven't got the message. Is a very awake-sounding penguin there. Well, a new study suggests that they're actually experts at having micro-naps. Our reporter Stephanie Prentice told my colleague Gareth Barlow about this research.
This was a team studying chin-strap penguins. They live in the southern Pacific and Antarctic oceans, and the team rounded some up and they monitored them using these electrodes that were implanted in their neck. And what they found was an extremely unusual sleep pattern. So these penguins, instead of having a block of sleep, as us humans are wont to do, they were taking thousands of small naps a day. I'm talking up to 10,000, and they were clocking up 11 hours of sleep in bursts of around 4 seconds. Now, an interesting element to this is a suggestion that, contrary to our prior assumptions, the benefits of sleep can be built up incrementally, well, in some species at least. The big question, of course, is how restful is that kind of sleep, which is hard to say, but the researchers said since the penguins were breeding successfully, they must have been getting some restorative sleep.
So up to 10,000 micro-naps of 4 seconds at a time. Why would they do this rather than just sleeping for 8 hours?
Well, it's working out for them in simple terms, and it's thought to be a matter of survival. So they're flightless birds. They're quite small, and the research suggested they need to stay vigilant to keep themselves safe. So these micro-naps are the best way to do that. Now, it also feeds into their parenting. So with penguins, one parent tends to keep a watch over an egg or eggs, while the other one goes out hunting for sometimes extended periods of time. The initial parent has to keep those eggs safe and also to protect that nest, because stealing nest material is actually rife in the penguin community. Right, Gareth. Now, in humans, this sort of pattern long-term, it could lead to major impacts on how we'd function and even long-term health issues. But for penguins, the study suggests, it really seems to be working. And the team did note this indicates that sleep, how sleep works, could be far more complex and far more diverse in any species, including us, than textbooks so far would suggest.
Our penguin correspondent, Stephanie Prentice. Well, that's it from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later on. If you'd like to comment, though, on any of the topics that we're covering, do send us an email. Our address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter. We're at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by the crested Matthew Cadman. The producer was the brush-tailed Olivia Ataber. The editor is Emperor Karen Martin. I'm Chris Berrow, and until next time. Which I believe is goodbye in penguin.